Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is December 15th, 2022, and this is episode 359. I'm the host, Mark Ames. I'm up here in Rochester, New York, getting our snow. Everyone's sick. Everyone in this house, pretty much, with something that seems like COVID or COVID-y, but apparently isn't after like 8 home tests.
I've been sick all week too. Yeah.
I've heard different people in different sort of parts of the Twitter world or whatever talk about getting something like this, where it's like it's the weirdest flu they've had in a while. And other people are saying, yeah, well, immunity systems have been sort of, you know, damaged one way or another from COVID. Either you've caught COVID or you spent time with masks and then you took masks off. And I got to say, this thing is freaking weird. You know, it leaves and then comes back with a vengeance and then leaves and comes back. So I'm going to do my best not to hack too much during this interview. Anyway, we're on the line, of course, with the War Nerd himself, John Dolan, Gary Brecher in Trieste. John, how you doing?
Had my own medical scare, and I'm okay. The doctor literally told me to go out and smell the flowers. Like, you know, you're too tense. That's the problem. And it's like, yeah, I know. It's like one of those medical advice bits where it's like, you know the way you are? Don't be that way. But anyway, basically good news. But I just wanted to say I love Trieste. I think this is one of the best cities in the world.
This is like 4 episodes in a row where you said you've loved Trieste, which is a record for any city I can think of.
I know. It's just a great city. Like today, I'm out. I'm trying to force Catherine to buy some clothes. Catherine, oddly enough, has to be just about held at gunpoint to buy clothes. And we walk past this plaque that she points out to me, and it's got the name of some Italian army veterans, and underneath it says Mogadishu. And this is how I find out about the Battle of Checkpoint Pasta. No kidding. I mean,
Checkpoint Pasta?
Yeah. In July 1993, there was a battle between Italian troops in Mogadishu and Muhammad Aidid, the same warlord who eventually was involved in the Black Hawk Down.
Yeah. Famous fight. Name for a brief while.
Yeah.
Famous bad guy.
Yeah. And this several Italian troops and quite a few more Somali militia guys were killed in this battle at a Berea pasta factory, which, by the way, hints at the Italian influence in the Horn of Africa from there.
Right.
Early 20th century colonial phase. And that's the thing about Italy. You see these extraordinary memories of the very wild, very star-studded 20th century history of the place.
How much longer are you guys there for? Do you know what your next move is? Or
we only have about a month left on our six-month visa. And then we've got to get out of the EU for a while. And we don't really feel a lot of enthusiasm about any place. You know, it would be nice to go someplace warm for the winter, but I don't really like the idea of a 25-hour flight to New Zealand or something.
Right.
Getting tired of those long flights.
Traveling and stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
It's tiring. Yeah. Well, hopefully you guys will be able to plant your War Nerd flag for good sometime soon.
So
let's get right to our interview. We have a great interview with, in fact, you know, John had said, I don't know, we were talking about episodes for December, like last month. And John, you had said, you know, what about Smedley Butler? I can't remember why you brought it up. And I was like, oh, yeah. And I thought we were going to wind up reading War is a Racket, you know, the famous book. But actually, it turns out there's a great book, really great book, written about Smedley Butler and sort of Smedley Butler as the thread to talk about a lot of things, particularly, you know, American imperialism, its imprints and so on. I mean, it's just a really good book. great guest. Let's get right to the interview. We're going to be speaking with Jonathan Katz, author of Gangsters of Capitalism, and let's get right to it. Okay, we are really excited to have with us our guest today, Jonathan Katz, to talk about somebody John and I were talking about for a while. We need to do an episode on Smedley Butler. And Jonathan's written a great book. A book that, it's the sort of book that as a writer you'd want to have written about, and I'll get into that in a minute anyway, about Smedley Butler. Jonathan is a journalist and author. His first book was The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. He served for I think 8 years as an Associated Press reporter, many of those years in Haiti. And he also runs writes a newsletter, theracket.news. We'll post links to that. And we're going to talk with him today about his new book that came out earlier this year, Gangsters of Capitalism, Smedley Butler, The Marines, and the Making and Breaking of America's Empire. So first of all, thanks for joining us and welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
I was just saying, like, one thing it's a great book, really great book. Yeah. And it's a great entryway into talking about all kinds of things, whether it's Smedley Butler, who was this Marines general who we're going to be talking about, or about American imperialism, or about the effects of American imperialism back and forth throughout the world and back in American domestic politics. But you have this thread, which is Smedley Butler's life, and you just go sort of, it's a perfect, very grim thread from one spot to another, to all these very obscure, I don't even know, I guess officially we wouldn't even call them wars, but there's a reason why we don't talk about them too. But from one sort of destructive conflict to another. And you mix that in with your own then personal, I mean, this is what I mean by sort of a writer's book as well. This is the kind of book you would like to write. I mean, you could write a book about Butler and it could be all almost overly polemical or something, and that would not have been as interesting. But in this, you're able to use Butler as a thread, as a way of visiting places, and then as a way of also, you can go off on any sort of related but tangent to tell all these other stories as well that tie back in. So it really worked out great. So anyway, first of all, just congratulations on that.
I really
appreciate
that. It took me, it was the book that I wanted to write in the way that I wanted to write it. It took a lot of doing and struggle to get there, but I'm glad it worked for you.
Yeah. I found the Philippines episode particularly interesting because that was a big and very nasty war fought by the American military, and it's almost forgotten now. Yeah. And you even got in on a movie, and there's a photo of you an extra or something in Goyo the Boy General. It's called.
Yes. Yeah. Available on Netflix.
I just saw they're available on Netflix. I haven't watched it yet. Are they good? I mean, I saw the reviews of it are pretty patronizing, which says to me maybe it's good. You know?
I would say, so it was the sequel to another movie called General Luna.
Right.
About Antonio Luna, who was one of the first commanders-in-chief of the war, the Philippine side of the war against the Americans. I think General Luna was a little bit better. Goyo... It doesn't quite land on. It tries to do a lot. I identify with it because I also wrote a book that tried to do.
You almost died, getting electrocuted.
Like, exactly. It's watchable. It's long and it's mostly in Tagalog. So you got to, it's like 3 hours. You got to strap in for a lot of exposition in Tagalog. But it's it's an interesting movie, and just as a cultural artifact and as a piece of historical memory, it's fascinating to me. Let me put it this way: I watched the whole thing. My wife fell asleep halfway through. So,
so it depends on your interest in that subject.
I hope you woke her up when you came on. Look, this is me.
I think she was awake for that part, and then she was like, "All right,
that's all I need." It's funny. So the subject, Smedley Butler, I mean, before we get into it, and I think the best way maybe to go about it is to kind of somewhat follow along the structure of your book. I think if people know who Smedley Butler is, first of all, it's like, it's almost like a cartoonishly ridiculous first name, Smedley Butler. I mean, it does sound like a Hanna-Barbera name, or was that like a Dudley Do-Right or Smedley Butler? I don't know. But if people know the name Smedley Butler, I think as a rule, they know his somewhat famous book, War is a Racket, which has been popular, I think, among people in the sort of, critical of the U.S. empire, critical of militarism. It's kind of a classic. So it was an underground classic, at least when I was younger. I think Feral House put out War is a Racket when I was younger.
Jesse Ventura did a foreword to one of the editions that came out.
Really? Wow.
I think that's in the odds. Okay. Yeah.
Right. Because, as I was saying before the show, I mean, if you heard about Smedley Butler, you heard that book, the name of the book. And so it was popular with libertarians, sort of libertarians who were mostly there for the anti-militarism, anti-imperialism, and anti-government, right? Because it's another thing that proves government's bad. And then, also anti-imperialist on the left. And then you'd heard his name in the murky, which has become sort of less murky over the last few years, the famous business plot, the alleged and quite possible. I think we just don't know the details of it, but there was clearly something afoot. Yeah. Plot to overthrow or at least destabilize FDR early in the New Deal after the business community turned against him. And basically, some of these business people had one of their representatives try and recruit Smedley Butler to be, the ringleader of a kind of mass veterans-led coup to overthrow FDR and stop the New Deal. But you didn't really know any more beyond that. And I think one of the problems with getting into the Smedley Butler story was that for a long time, it really was kind of, I don't know if you found this, but at least when I was younger, it was kind of owned more or less by like conspiracist on the far right. I want to say Eustace Mullins. Was that his name? That weird Bircher guy who thinks the Fed was a Masonic conspiracy or something like that. That it was kind of somewhat owned by those people. So that scared away, I think, a lot of other people from looking too much into it. But when I used to do a lot of writing about libertarianism, the origins, the early days, I mean, when you go back to the Liberty League, the American Liberty League. I mean, it's basically those same people that set up the American Liberty League. You know, the DuPonts and Morgan and some of these others, they were at the same time involved in this, plot with Smedley Butler.
Yeah.
But I guess, I don't know. The first question is, what made you decide to write a book on Smedley Butler? What brought you to that story? And, did any of this stuff, and the fact that people kind of knew him, that he was already sort of maybe pigeonholed, did that worry you at all? Or how did you approach it?
Yeah, no, those are all really good questions. I would say I was somewhat inoculated from that, or maybe came in initially a little bit oblivious to that, because I came into Butler through from an American standpoint, an unconventional point of view. Like, I learned about him in Haiti. I talk about this a little in the book. It was really while I was writing my first book, The Big Truck That Went By, I was writing a chapter on the history of Haiti to explain, how things had gotten so fragile that a magnitude 7 earthquake became the deadliest earthquake ever recorded in the Western Hemisphere. And that just required sort of, going back and excavating a little bit of the history of really American imperialism. You can't talk about the 20th century in Haiti. You can't talk about the way things were in 2010 or even now in 2022 without talking about the U.S. occupation of Haiti, which was a thing that I didn't know anything about until I moved to Haiti. And I know that, and I was pretty well read. I was in American studies, American history major in college. I actually, one of my first and favorite classes in college was like a very you know, from some points you would call it like a revisionist history, but it was just history mm-hmm. of like United States during the Cold War. It was just a history of like, you know, the coups that we, you know, the CIA oversaw against, right. you know, Mossadegh in Iran and Arbenz in Guatemala, et cetera. Right. But I hadn't heard anything about the invasion and occupation of Haiti.
Yeah.
It just reminds me of the epigraph to your book, exactly. Haitian proverb.
Such a great proverb.
Yeah, yeah. The one who strikes the blow forgets. The one who bears the scar remembers.
Exactly, yeah. By Coublier, Pote Maxanger, you say in Creole. It was so because I came into it knowing Butler primarily as a villain, really. I mean, I knew him as the guy who carried out the massacre at Fort Rivier, which was the battle that right. Butler got his second Medal of Honor for. You know, as the guy who dissolved Parliament in 1917, the guy who
that's an amazing story, by the way. Mm. That whole dissolving the Parliament and then making sure the records are burned, you know, or basically right? yeah. disappeared.
Yeah, because of that, so it was in that initial round of basically, you know, research. For the big truck that I just stuck his name into Google. And that was the first time that I ever heard of War as a Racket or The Business Plot. In fact, at first I was like, this can't be the same guy, right? How did this guy who Haitians literally called the devil, how did he then, you know, it must be his son. It must be like some like father's son, like discord or something like that. Yeah. He did have a son named Smedley, but it was him. And it was that story that really kind of got stuck in my brain. And I realized, once I realized the extent to which he was, you know, in a lot of ways, the main character of American imperialism for the first decades of the 20th century, and the extent to which his, you know, sort of late in life or gradual, you know, there are two ways to look at it, turnabout was a way to understand sort of the eternal misgivings that Americans, and we're not unique in that, all imperialists, you know, British imperialists, Spanish imperialists, there are examples of this in every empire. But, you know, the way in which that could tell a larger story about America and our place in the world and the way that people, you know, in other countries look at us, that was why I wanted to get into it. As I was doing research, you know, and this book took, you know, basically 5 years in the writing,
wow.
kind of 7 years in the mm-hmm. making, I definitely encountered a lot of people, a lot of scholars, especially, you know, a couple in particular that I remember who were just sort of like, you know, when you said Smedley Butler, my normal reaction is like, this guy must be crazy. Like anybody who comes to me talking about Smedley Butler must be a nut job. But I came, you know, sort of well enough credentialed from my other work that they were like, you know, well, I guess I'll hear this guy out.
Right.
But I definitely encountered that.
There was a really strong effort to discredit the whole idea of the business plot for a series of reasons. Did you find that there's still that doubt about the existence of this plot?
First of all, yes, definitely. I've encountered plenty of people online, and especially, I mean, not necessarily people who've really spent any time looking into it, mm-hmm. But there is just sort of a reflex reaction. You know, as you guys were saying, like it has become it's a conspiracy theory. It's a theory of it is a conspiracy, and talking about it, you know, it involves talking about a conspiracy, and so it has become the domain of conspiracy theorists. Right. In one of the versions of Loose Change that was circulating online, they did like a postscript about the business plot, which didn't make any sense. Like even in the context of a film, that didn't really make a whole lot of sense. Like it was like. Right. I think they were just sort of doing that to be like, look, see, there are real conspiracies. So the one that we're talking about must be valid. But, you know, in general, like I haven't encountered anybody who has really looked into it in any kind of detail, who is like, you know, this is crazy. It's mostly people who sort of, you know, glance at the Wikipedia page or hear, you know, conspiracy theorists call forth about it.
And I think it's only kind of, I don't know, in the last 5 to 10 years, not total fringe people have kind of looked at it again and considered it. And because before then, I just don't think people were interested in hearing about it.
Right.
If I remember right from my research on it, I think even FDR and his people were sort of like, we want to bring this out in the open to know that we can, you know, to stop it and to name some names, but we don't want to get too deeply into it because it's kind of, it's destabilizing to make too much hay of it in a sense too. I mean, it could also be destabilizing. And as if I recall right, I think, you know, FDR sort of didn't want to make too much of it either. He just sort of, he was all right with him getting it out there, but I think he sort of advised Dixon, you know, don't push this too far. Don't drag more people.
That seems to be, I mean, that's certainly my working theory is that essentially, you know, I think insofar as FDR thought he could get any political benefit out of it being public, he had already gotten it from the amount of publicity that Butler had already brought to it, and then Butler took the hit.
Right, exactly.
I mean, one of the criticisms of that I've encountered online of from people who respectable-ish scholars, right? That they're sort of like, well, this was just Butler trying to get publicity for himself. But if that was his goal, it wasn't his goal, and second of all, it completely backfired. I mean, it really discredited him. It made because he got just mocked. He just was dragged relentlessly by the New York Times, by Times Magazine. Yeah. They Henry Luce and Adolph Oakes specifically, they wanted to do everything possible to make him seem ridiculous. So FDR kind of was able to have his cake and eat it too. The whistle was blown. The plot, embryonic or well-formed as it may have been, we have no idea. At least I don't know yet. Maybe there's some more research that I can do to try to answer that question. But by blowing the whistle, it seems to have kind of fallen apart of its own volition. And then he didn't have to then go out in public and be like, I'm so weak that these, powerful American forces are trying to overthrow me. And B, I'm not crazy. I'm not alleging this conspiracy against me for which, maybe there's only a little bit of somewhat circumstantial evidence. But that's one of the theories. But the one thing that I will say is that is interesting is that the moments in history since the business plot, so that Butler reveals it in 1934, that it has sort of reemerged. You can say the same to a certain extent about War as a Racket and Butler's anti-imperialism in general, are sort of at moments of great questioning and embarrassment of the empire in the United States. So in the 1970s, in the aftermath of Vietnam, of our involvement in Vietnam, you have Jules Archer writes his book, The Plot to Seize the White House, which was, one of the only books out there about the business plot for a long time. You've got, people in the military who are starting to circulate, copies of War as a Racket again. Mm-hmm. And now, we're at the outset of, the catastrophe in Iraq. Depending on how you look at it, some things were accomplished, not necessarily good things, in the war on terror. It may be giving them too much credit even to say that the whole thing was a failure, because a lot of money got made and a lot of, the military industrial complex did very well. But broadly speaking, we're at this moment right now where, the Taliban defeated the United States in Afghanistan. We don't like Americans in the respectable media don't like to talk about it that way. We just talk about it sort of George Packer wrote his piece in The Atlantic a couple weeks ago where he just sort of referred to it vaguely as like the fall of Afghanistan. Like, oh, we...
wow.
Afghanistan
that thing tripped. Happened. Yeah.
It was up.
And then it was down. Yeah.
The U.S. is defeated by the Taliban. We're sort of in this period of, somewhat limited, not really on a full imperial scale, but somewhat limited, at least attitudinal retrenchment. Mm-hmm. It's in moments like that that people are like, "Hey, maybe."
Right.
Maybe and of course the January 6th business really blew the whole cortex of mainstream opinion. So they might be more willing to consider domestic application. And you know, Butler was clear about this, that he was talking about bringing those wars home and doing something domestic. And it seems as if, even though he didn't say this as far as I know, but that's where he drew a line. Like, I'm not gonna do it to my own country.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, that's very much the case. I mean, in my newsletter, actually, I wrote a piece comparing, what I called, riffing on the title of Jules Archer's book, Trump's Plot to Seize the White House, to the business plot. Mm-hmm. I wrote a piece because I had been watching, from sort of the whatever it was, the 2 a.m., illegal press conference, hijack, the legal, hatchack, excuse me, a legal press conference in the East Wing of the White House on election night, through the Kraken and like the conspiracy theories about, the voting machines and things like that. I was seeing this sort of, coup in the offing, and I saw so many parallels to the things that, happened in the business plot and the Butler was talking about in the early 1930s, that I wrote a newsletter about, the headline was something along the lines of, like, in Trump's plot to seize the White House, who will be our Smedley Butler? I put that on January 4th. Wow. Then obviously when 2 days later, as a citizen, I couldn't have hoped for a worse outcome. As a writer, I was like, well, that panned out. I was ready to go on that stuff. Yeah. And watching, January 6th through the lens of the research that I've been doing. So one of the things that one of the details is that so Butler is approached by Gerald C. McGuire, who's a bond salesman, member of the American Legion, representative of the financial house, to recruit him into this coup. And McGuire has gone on this junket across basically fascist Europe. He's visited Rome. He's visited Berlin, where Hitler has just taken power. And the main thing is that he's visited Paris, where 6 weeks before he got there, there was a fascist coup, or an attempted fascist coup of fascist and far-right groups, veterans groups, sort of this, these motley organizations. It was on February 6, 1934, so it's still known in France as the 6 février, as February 6th. Mm-hmm. They rushed the seat of the French legislature, the Palais Bourbon, to basically prevent a transfer of power to a center-left government. On a conspiracy theory, first of all, an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, which I won't get into, but just, they blame the Jews. And then they were also like, and they were basically like this alliance between, the Jews and what was known as the Radical Party, but, from our standpoint, it's the center-left party. It was basically the right. Democratic Party of France in 1934, that basically they were going to usher in a Marxist dictatorship. and they, it ended up being a complete catastrophe. Like the rioters didn't make it to the Palais Bourbon. They basically ended up clashing with police. Most of the people who died were the rioters, some police, a couple of bystanders. But it did succeed in putting French politics into a tailspin, and did succeed because it was a parliamentary system in the center-left party not coming to power, a conservative coming to power instead, and ended up inspiring both the popular front of leftists and liberals that ended up sort of being able to hold off fascism until the Nazis invaded. And then once the Nazis invaded, a lot of people who end up going to the Vichy regime had participated or came out of the aftermath of that fascist attempted coup. And Jerry Maguire, when he comes to Butler, he says specifically that he has met with the Croix de Feu, the Fiery Cross, which was one of the veterans, the sort of far-right, quasi-fascist veterans organizations that had carried out this attempted attack. And he says to Butler, this is the sort of organization we're going to have. What he's saying is, we are going to specifically turn the American Legion, which already was very much, people don't really remember this today because the American Legion is still around, but it was very much a street fighting cadre. Like they they were big on
Union busters and yeah, they beat up anybody on the left. They were, it was one step away from like the black shirts, right?
Exactly. I mean, they were in the eschatology of like American far right groups today, they were maybe a little bit more like the Oath Keepers than the Proud Boys, but they were really on that end, especially especially the street fighting part.
And big.
Was it big?
I mean, they had huge numbers. So it was for real.
And as you know, as I say in the book, like they used to at their annual conventions, they would present greetings from a wounded veteran of the Great War, Signor Mussolini. They invited Mussolini to speak at their 1930 convention, only to have that to be forced to rescind that invitation in the face of basically labor protests. But anyway, all that is to say that what, you know, what Maguire had in mind, insofar as we can, you know, envision what Maguire had in mind, he was trying to basically do a 6 Février in Washington. And, you know, there was like January 6th, 6 February. It's even the same day of the month.
I know, it's pretty weird.
I mean, I think that especially, you know, there's a deep and abiding conviction that many Americans have had for many generations, that as Sinclair Lewis, who also crossed paths with Smedley Butler, you know, titled his book sarcastically, you know, "It Can't Happen Here." Saul Bellow wrote a response to that, by the way, called "The Hell It Can't." there is that longstanding notion that a lot of Americans have that, oh, you know, we can't possibly have fascism because, you know, we are America, we are special, we have been vaccinated against that. I think what, you know, what January 6th, what the whole Trump experience and the ongoing Trump experience has shown not everybody, but a large number of Americans, is that, you know, that kind of authoritarianism can happen here, that, you know, fascism can happen here. And I think that has, you know, that opens up a lot of people's eyes. It certainly is something that opened up my eye and also, you know, my experience overseas and seeing the things that the United States actually does do in the world, opened up my eyes to the possibility that, you know, when I read about a mooted fascist coup in the United States, I'm just like, yeah, that tracks. That sounds like a part of America that I know.
For listeners out there, I mean, to understand the gravity of this business plot, it wasn't, I mean, the bond trader was sort of the guy, you know, bringing in the wads of cash and showing off and talking about the plan, but he was directly connected to real heavyweights, starting with his boss, Grayson Murphy, who, you know, J.P. Morgan, you know, military intelligence, a buddy with Wild Bill Donovan in the 20s that, you know, I mean, there were real heavy hitters. And I mean, I remember reading a book, The Corporate State and the Broker State, about DuPont, which DuPont in its day, well, for a long time, I mean, it was sort of like Coke Industries plus, and extremely powerful, extremely influential in right-wing politics. And those guys also were up to their eyeballs in this plot. So it was real people. And, you know, it might have been an actual fascist coup, but it might have been a threat, like a much scarier Tea Party where you bring all these veterans there and force, you know, knock the New Deal off its rails or you know, whatever it was to gain some leverage. But it was, the people behind it were very real. And
Grayson Murphy is to me the key to understanding this. And the reason why I haven't actually seen anyone go, you know, anywhere near as much in detail about Grayson Murphy's past as I did in the chapter that I wrote about it. And it wasn't, you know, because of any, you know, special genius that I had. It was because of the direction that I came to the story from. Like I came to it from I was doing research and I've, you know, lived my life, you know, sort of in, you know, at the peripheries of the American Empire and in you know, the imbrications of you know, capital and military power. And that was the book that I really set out to write. So I wasn't, it wasn't really until January 6th. I knew I was going to have the business plot in the book somewhere because how do you write a book? You can't write a book about Smedley Butler without the business plot. First of all, it's too interesting. And second of all, people who pick it up are going to be very disappointed. But I wasn't sure, you know, when I set out to write this book, so I pitched this thing in 2016. And at that time, that's when I, you know, sold it off proposal to the publisher. And at that time, I thought I was going to be writing a book. I was going to do the past present thing. And I thought that, you know, the present was going to be, you know, this long buildup to the apotheosis of America's great neoliberal empire under the sure to be and soon to be president Hillary Rodham Clinton. So I didn't. I mean, I had no idea that I was going to be writing a book, about the Trump presidency. Even the morning of that election, I didn't know that this was going to turn into. And I knew there was a possibility, but I didn't. I was one of the. Maybe I was just fooling myself. I guess I was, but I thought I would. No. Yeah. But it can't happen. And so it was because, you know, I think that a lot of people who come to the business plot from a position of American politics, you know, you got two political parties and you've got, you know, the history of America, you know, as told from the imperial center, you know, the view from the metropole, like this seems ridiculous. This can't happen here. But from the perspective of all the things that I am, you know, sort of living in historical memory and researching, you know, Butler, you know, and the Marines, you know, dissolving the Haitian parliament. That was, again, that was like a Cease Février, January 6th style thing, except it worked, right? They actually dissolved the legislature. It didn't meet again for 12 years. You know, Butler helping to overthrow and then protect the puppet government of Nicaragua. All of these, you know, of Honduras, of et cetera. And all, like, coming to it, you know, the Panama conspiracy, right? Like, like it was, if you know, and historians of Panama, people who understand the history of Panama know this, but people who don't know Panama and don't know what happened, I mean, just very briefly, like it was part of Colombia and we severed it from Colombia with the help of Panamanian elites. It was a state of Colombia at the time, build the Panama Canal. It was 100% a conspiracy. There's no other way to describe it. The bagman for William Nelson Cromwell of Sullivan.
I was going to say Sullivan and Cromwell. You know, again, yeah, features big in their book. But go ahead.
Exactly. Roger Farnham, who is his go-between, and ends up he's one of these figures, like Smedley Butler. Like, there's all these kind of Zelig-like figures that just show up everywhere, and he's one of them. He's
on like every board and every bagman. It's amazing where he shows up.
Yeah. And he plays a huge role in the invasion and occupation of Haiti. He basically is the one who puts the bug into William Jennings Bryan's ear. It's like, why don't we rob the Central Bank of Haiti? And then in his successors, to like, why don't we invade? Anyway, so, you know, Farnham writes a news, he plants a newspaper article ahead of what happens on November 3rd, 1903, that basically says on November 3rd, because it's election day in the United States, nobody's going to be paying attention. On November 3rd, U.S. warships are going to come, and there's going to be an uprising in the state of Panama, and it's going to declare independence from Colombia, and that's what happened. I mean, it would be unbelievable, except it's what happened. And so, Grayson Murphy, who is Jerry Maguire's boss in the business plot. So Grayson Murphy is in military intelligence. He is posted to South and Central America and comes back to personally brief Teddy Roosevelt, the president of the United States, on things that are happening in the state of Panama whatever it was, 2-3 weeks. It was in October of 1903, before this takes place. So when you come to it from that perspective,
experience in a plot. So does Smedley Butler, and they probably just wrongly figured, you know, he's one of us.
Exactly.
He's overthrown democracies. He's done this. He knows how the game works, right?
Yeah. So it becomes much easier to look at that resume and be like, oh, I mean, of course, like, you know, again, that's, you know, maybe somewhat circumstantial, but it's like, it's not a stretch to think that this guy who set up a private intelligence network with Wild Bill Donovan, as you said, the head of the OSS in Europe after World War I, could think, you know, and was, by the way, the treasurer of the Liberty League, which was founded by the DuPonts, which is supposed to be the money behind this thing.
Right.
You know, it's not, for me, not a stretch.
Yeah. I think that's a great way. So because that's also how you open your book, with that kind of spectacular episode. And then you go back through Butler's history, and again, using him as a thread. And it's a great thread. I mean, it's strange. Like, Butler is, I was talking with John a little bit about this. He's a hero to a lot of people because he took that step, because, you know, war is a racket. And it is a heroic, great thing that he went public with this plot against FDR. It's a great thing, you know, unless you're a DuPont, you know, or a Morgan. But he's a somewhat familiar figure, alien to my world, but is it like, you know, suburban Californian Jew or whatever? But I come across these types when I read about him, this fierce upper class Quakers. There's a lot of them.
Aspect is really interesting.
It is.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about where he comes from, his background. He's a very unlikely future sort of hero of anti-imperialism, that's for sure. But
yes, yes. Well, yeah, yeah. So yeah, the Quaker part especially. Although as I excavate, there's a nasty side to the history of Quakerism, and you know, there are also other Quakers in the 20th century like Herbert Hoover and Richard Nixon, who also came out of that, you know, perhaps unlikely background.
Right.
Butler comes from the main line of Philadelphia, just off the actual main line of public works in Westchester. And he is from a just straight up upper class family, old Quaker family, basically came over with William Penn just after. His father's a congressman. His grandfather, Smedley Darlington, which is who he was named for, was also a congressman. And you know, his mother is basically, you know, the heir to, it's not a fortune, but it's a lot of money. I mean, they're very well connected in banking and law, on the main line, which anybody who's been to Philly knows that's still the place where the rich people live, around Philadelphia. And he, you know, goes to a Ponzi, you know, private school for Quaker boys, on the grounds of Haverford College. It's still there, the Haverford School. I visited it while I was on the main line.
As a quarterback, too, one of those guys.
Yeah. Yep. And he joins up because it's 1898. The Maine has just been sunk or blown up, depending on how you look at it. And or blew itself up is probably the most likely.
Right.
It was probably an accident, honestly.
Right.
Well, yeah, they were storing ammunition in tremendous heat inside metal gun turrets.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. It was one of America's first two steel battleships. They didn't really know how to do it yet, basically.
Yeah, right.
And he's caught up in war fever. It is very much, you know, for people my age, I'm in my early 40s, you know, for people my age, it's very reminiscent of 9/11.
Yes.
It was just, you know, America's been attacked by a dastardly empire. And by the way, Spain was a dastardly empire.
Yeah, that's the tricky part. It's not like, you know, Spain has to be rehabilitated here. The Spanish Empire, wherever it went, was just God awful.
Yeah. I mean, in the same way, like, you don't have to rehabilitate Al Qaeda and you don't have to rehabilitate Saddam Hussein. It's like there's many bad people in the world doing many bad things in many different places.
Yeah.
And you know, it was sort of that, you know, it was a combination of sort of the, you know, it was propaganda, but it was propaganda based on real things. I mean, the Spanish invented concentration camps in, right. in Cuba. They were killing women and children. They were torturing, freedom fighters to death. And Butler was reading about those things, both in the Quaker and the regular press. And then, you know, the Maine blows up. And, you know, his line that he says later on in his memoirs is, you know, I was determined to shoulder a rifle and help free little Cuba. It's a very paternalistic way of looking at it. I don't think the Cuban Mambises were actually waiting for a 16-year-old from Westchester, Pennsylvania to come and free them. But he, you know, it was that, you know, and his parents, you know, support that helped him sort of overcome, you know, the Quaker peace testimony, mm-hmm. You know, a very fervent, obviously famously anti-war stance to basically be like, look, I'm fighting on the side of the angels here. I'm going to go mm-hmm. help these people. And that's what got him into the Marine Corps, because the Marines were happy to have anybody they could get their hands on. And he just loved it so much that he stayed.
Right. I got to say, there's a great quote here while we're on the subject of Cuba that you found of Jose Marti, because he spent a couple of years in exile in the U.S. before going back, you know, trying to rally resources and support for the Cuban rebellion against the Spanish. And he writes, after having lived there, he says, I lived inside the monster and I know its guts. About living in the U.S. is a great quote.
Yeah,
by way of saying, we better get this revolution won immediately.
Yes, ASAP.
Start setting up a government or the Americans are going to move in.
Castro riffs on that when he's giving his defense at his trial, and I guess 1954, he describes Batista as it's something along the lines of un monstruo que ni siquiera tiene entrañas, like a monster that doesn't even have guts.
That's amazing. It's kind of brutal that the CIA's radio, isn't it? It was like the CIA's sort of radio-free Cuba is called Jose Marti.
Radio Marti.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he's like Marti is one of those figures who. He's, you know, anybody who believes in sort of a Cuba that should be independent from Spain, you know, sees themselves as the heir to Martí. So both Castro and the anti-Castro forces both think that they are the true heirs to Martí.
Yeah.
One of the aspects of Butler's career, by the way, that first name, it just keeps striking me. It's like, it's a weird thing in America. Like if somebody has a weird first name like that, it means either they're very upper class or they're very rural lower class or something.
Yes.
It's just, it's not a middle class thing to call you.
I can tell you guys, I actually ran this down. I think I figured out where it came from. There's a name called Smedley that is attested in the Doomsday Book, the Register of Medieval England Places, the original sort of tax book. The town doesn't exist anymore. I think it was in the Midlands. But the assumption is that it was probably a corruption of smithing. It was probably like a town where smithing happened, where like manufacturing happened. And then it became a last name. And then in high WASP tradition and also low WASP tradition, as you say, it then works its way into, it's actually the Darlington family. It's actually Butler's mother's family as a first name.
So I was going to say that, we've been doing a Civil War series and the Marine Corps has no major role in the Civil War. It's like they have gone by the end of the 19th century into real prominence, and Smedley Butler is part of that prominence. I assume that's part of the kind of wars that the U.S. was fighting, like, you know, when a client gives you trouble, you send the gunboats, but you also send the infantry in the form of the Marines.
Exactly. Yeah, they grew up together. The Marines, you know, famously, if you go to Marine Ball, they like to trace their origins to the American Revolution. Really, more technically, it was John Adams who incorporates it in the 1790s. But as you say, like, they didn't have a big role because, they were basically ship guards. Like, it was essentially, you know, in the 19th century, when, you know, you would send a naval ship somewhere to do a thing, they were infantry on the ship. And if you needed somebody to go on shore and do an extra thing, you sent in the Marines. And, you know, the number of things that the Marines did of note in the 19th century were so few that they basically all made it into the song. Like,
Boy plays. Everybody gets a verse.
Yeah, exactly. It's the Halls of Montezuma, that's the Mexican-American War, and the Shores of Tripoli, that's the Barbary War. That's it. Like, those are the only things that the Marines did. So in the beginning of the 20th century, what the Marines do is they really provide presidents, starting with William McKinley, who's president during the Spanish-American War, but more importantly, during the invasion to crush the Boxer Rebellion in China in 1900. What they give is essentially plausible deniability, because if you send the army somewhere, like, it's very hard to make the case that you're not invading, right? The army also wasn't particularly good at getting on boats and going other places. That was why the Marines got into the fight in Cuba first. The reason why the Marines are first ashore at Guantanamo Bay, which ends up being Smedley Butler's first posting, is because the Marines know how to pick up a gun, get on a boat, pick up the gun again, and get off the boat. Like, that's what they knew how to do. And the army didn't really know how to do that, because throughout the 19th century, they had been fighting the Civil War and then the wars, you know, of ethnic cleansing against the Native Americans.
Right, which were mainly cavalry wars. So it was like, you know, land-based infantry, then cavalry. And
exactly.
There was no need for an amphibious force most of the time.
But what the Marines give you, they are known in some quarters as, you know, as the State Department's army or the State Department's infantry. What they give you is the ability to, you know, project, you know, using a Navy ship, far away. And then, like I said, you know, have kind of plausible deniability. It's like, look, we're not invading. We're just sending in a couple of Marines. They're just, you know, they're just, they're on the ground.
A few people or help.
This was something the European powers, particularly Britain, had perfected throughout the course of the century. If you look at the conquest of Burma, for example, it's like, no, we're just going to recover some debts from a couple of our guys who got cheated, and next thing you know, they're occupying the capital. So,
exactly. Or in Alexandria, in Egypt, in the 1880s, which is where Smedley's extraordinarily racist mentor, Littleton Waller, that was where he cut his teeth. That was again one of the few. It wasn't really of note. It didn't make it into the song. But the Marines came ashore in Egypt then, and that was the same thing. It was a debt collection mission. And that's what these wars that Butler is participating in, small wars, you can call them, but from the it sort of depends on whose perspective. From the perspective of the people who are getting invaded, it's just a war. When you see these guys coming over the hill, it doesn't matter if they've got an Eagle Globe and anchor or army sabers on. Like, it's the same thing to them. But from the perspective of the United States, it was cheaper, easier, quicker, and would attract less attention and afford more plausible deniability to send in the Marines. And that really, I mean, you know, one of the things that is, you know, striking about Butler is that, you know, he's Zelig, he's Forrest Gump, he's everywhere. But it's not some kind of superpower on his part. It's because he's a Marine. There aren't that many Marines, and the Marines are sent everywhere.
Yeah, he's tremendously enthusiastic in the beginning, isn't he? I mean, there's absolutely no trace of this proto whistleblower at all that I see in your description of Butler as a 17-year-old Marine.
No, he's headstrong. I mean, he definitely is. You know, you see the elements personality-wise to get a bit Freudian on Smedley, to get really Freudian about him, he really just seems to be obsessed with impressing his mother at every stage along the way.
I think you mentioned that in another era, she might have gone out and joined up herself.
100%. Right. She was that kind of, you know, jingo woman.
Yeah.
There's a quick spot in I think it's in the Luzon chapter in the first Philippines chapter where he writes her, you know, asking her to get his father, who's a congressman, and you know, to write the president or somebody who has power to basically, you know, get him, you know, move to a different post closer to the action. He actually is at that moment asking for a transfer to the army, because the army at that moment is closer to the front lines than their Marine unit happens to be. You know, so you see in that respect, you know, a guy who is willing to rock the boat, make trouble, you know, put himself a little bit at risk to get the thing that he wants and the thing that he thinks is just and right. It just so happens that at that moment, the things that he thinks is just and right is for him to be the best Marine and the best, you know, best colonialist possible. You know, he gets in as a true believer. And really, the one thing that stays constant throughout Smedley Butler's life is that he is throughout at every swing of the pendulum, he is a true believer. He's like, Cuba should be free. I'm going to go fight for it myself. You know, I think that, you know, in the 20s, he gets into prohibition after having been just an excessive drinker earlier in his life. And when he decides to go dry, man, does he go dry. And he's like trying to ring up, you know, his friends in the Marine Corps on court martials for violating prohibition.
Yeah, you said he makes himself very unpopular in Philadelphia, right? By really smashing the taverns.
That's exactly it. Yeah, so one of the things that he does is, you know, he militarizes the Philadelphia police force by bringing these colonial tactics to it, which are still things that we see in American police forces today. But he does it unapologetically and not really caring who, you know, that's more powerful than him gets their toes stepped on. So once he starts encountering he's there to smash vice. He's there to smash the gangsters. But once he realizes that the gangsters, the racketeers, this is where he gets the idea of racketeer from. Once he realizes that the racketeers are like in cahoots with like these like leading, you know, Republican politicians in Philadelphia, that he doesn't stop. He just keeps going and ends up basically getting fired and having to go back to the Marine Corps because of it. He is somebody who at every point in his life, when he gets an idea of what is just and right, he goes for it, and he does not care what the consequences are for himself, and he doesn't really care what the consequences are for anybody else.
Right. That's one thing I was wondering about the book. I was wondering if there's a particular moment where empathy triumphs, but it's not so much like that as you tell the story. It's more like righteousness triumphing. Yes.
Yeah, I think that's right. The fulcrum for me in going through his letters, which I spent a long time doing, to the point that I became fluent in reading Smedley's handwriting, which was not an easy thing to do. Yeah.
And all the V's and thous, you know, that
was it took a lot of practice. Is in Nicaragua. And the thing that happens in Nicaragua, there's a couple things that happen in Nicaragua that sort of, you know, provide this sort of jumping off point for him. It starts in 1909, and then his last dance in Nicaragua is in 1912. And two things are happening in Nicaragua. One is that, you know, American colonialism, it has shed a lot of its pretense that it had been wearing for the last, 12, 14 years, going back to the Spanish-American War. In Cuba, you could be like, well, you know, we're fighting against, you know, Spanish imperialism. That's also how the Americans get involved in the Philippines. In the Boxer Rebellion, you can be like, well, you know, we're defending missionaries. And none of that's really true, but like you can sort of, you know, pretend. What's happened in Nicaragua is dollar diplomacy has now come into form. And, you know, essentially the Taft administration has decided, look, this war that we just fought in the Philippines, that's still going on in the southern provinces of Mindanao and the Sula Archipelago in the Philippines at this point, is extremely costly, is extremely deadly, and it's garnering a lot of backlash and embarrassment in front of the American electorate. Instead of doing that, let's do it financially. Let's go and, you know, control Nicaragua by controlling its financial system. We'll charter a central bank. We'll issue a new American-run currency. And we'll install a puppet president, and we will use the Marines because of their plausible deniability, right? Mm-hmm. And one thing is that it's a lot harder to miss. I mean, as one of the details that I point out is that during one of the invasions, I think it's the 1912, Butler bivouacked half of his troops, half of his Marines, in the U.S.-run central bank of Nicaragua, right. because they're being guided into Managua, into the capital, by the representative of the American banking houses, Brown Brothers and J.W. Seligman and Company, that are running Nicaraguan finances. The other thing is, on a more personal level, that Butler has just gotten promoted to major, and because he is now a flag officer, he is now able to travel a little bit more freely, choose the people that he talks to. Before this, he's really just, you know, a clicking heels toy soldier, right, following orders. You know, he's making decisions about sort of, you know, which way to run up the hill, if that. But, like, he's really just going where he's told. It's in Nicaragua for the first time that he's actually going around. He's talking to the locals. He's meeting these, you know, wildcat American bankers who have come down to Nicaragua to make their small fortunes. And he's realizing that, like, you know, I don't think that we're doing the things that I was told that we were doing. And it's from that point on. And, you know, this is one of the things that, you know, I don't mean this to be in any way an absolution for him, because most of the worst things that he does militarily in his career come after this, right? Everything he does in both of his medals of honor, everything he does in Haiti, all of that comes after this experience in Nicaragua. But nonetheless, you know, he is perhaps starting to garner maybe a small sense of empathy for the people who, you know, as he says, you know, in Nicaragua, you know, the poor people will be the ones who suffer, and their blood, right, will be on our heads. There's some traces of that kind of empathy, but it's really
getting cynical, right? Exactly. I mean, no longer, mm-hmm, you can sense in those letters you quote that he's starting to just see through the bullshit,
exactly,
and like writing home about it. Exactly. So that,
yeah, he eventually writes, his description in that famous paragraph, which is usually the one thing of his book that gets quoted. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers. I brought light. He's getting bitter here. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for the American sugar interests.
Right. The story's, it's a grim, if you're American, maybe if you're not as well, it's pretty depressing stuff, because it's just sort of example after example. I mean, I don't know if, so you're a little bit younger than I am. I mean, for many frustrating years, you couldn't really say, for example, something like America's obviously an empire. In like polite company, you would be, again, a conspiracy theorist or a, you know, fringer or whatever. I don't know. There's sort of two ways I'd want to approach it, but one of them is just intellectually, like, you know, it's just a fact. Like, wait, you don't. I mean, like, get out of this sort of fairy tale world. It's a simple, grim fact. It's not the same kind of empire. It doesn't have legions of Romans with big, you know, brushes on their helmets, or British helmets, or it operates. It looks a bit different. It has different trappings, but of course it's an empire. And it's one of the really good things about your book, without being overly polemical in any way, you're just describing how that empire functions, again, through this thread of this character, Smedley Butler, and he sees it too. And of course, you'd really have to have, I mean, I imagine most people involved in the guts of that understand that's just, you know, that's how it is. And they justify it to themselves. Well, it's how it is. Or they wouldn't justify it to themselves. Maybe they back out of it. But like, let's go through a couple of these stories. I mean, it's really interesting and, I don't know, relevant or, you know, ironic, whatever you'd say, that Butler's first overseas deployment is literally to Guantanamo Bay. I mean, that's where he first lands, which is synonymous with, like, everything that went wrong or bad, let's say everything bad about the war on terror, you know, from whose point of view it's wrong is another question.
Right.
But what's his experience like, I guess, if you could just briefly sum it up, in the Spanish-American War there in Cuba and then in and then we'll go to the Philippines.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, the theater of the Spanish-American War that he really sees combat in, that he really does more things in, is in the Philippines.
Right.
By the time he gets to Guantanamo, the Marines had taken it a couple weeks earlier. The big battle, which is the Battle of Cusco Well, had already been fought. And the Spanish had basically with the assistance of not even the assistance, the leadership of the Cuban Mambises.
By the way, it's a good little war. I mean, people who like to read war stories also. They're just
Cubans get whitewashed out. Well, very much whitewashed out of the story, but they're the ones who figure out there's only one well in this area.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Spanish troops depend for their water on that well. If we can take the well, they got to leave. And they're the ones who do most of the fighting.
And it starts off with friendly fire.
Yeah.
And this guy who runs up to a hill semaphoring or something like
that. Yeah. Sergeant Quick.
It's a great story, by the way.
Yeah. I just wanted to note it was Stephen Crane, the author of The Red Badge of Courage, who does sort of the initial whitewashing. He's a correspondent there for Joseph Pulitzer.
Yeah,
I gotta say, when we were doing the Civil War series, Red Badge of Courage, it doesn't quite make the cut. It's not, it's not that good.
I feel better about that now after reading the book too. I mean, that was he does not come off well there in that book at all. Yeah. No. Real jerk. So he lands in Guantanamo, but already the battle there has already happened, but he thinks he's going to get into some battles there.
What he's doing there is he's basically patrolling the perimeter.
Right.
And he's getting tutored into Marine manhood is essentially what he does, and getting sick, getting some kind of mosquito-borne illness, which was the fate of a lot of people in the war.
Yeah, and he gets sick a lot throughout your book, too, in those first 10, 15 years.
I've had also several mosquito-borne illnesses. There were many things that I identified with Smedley Butler.
Which ones did you have?
I've had dengue. I've had, I got Zika.
Ooh, damn.
That wasn't a fun one. Dengue was actually the worst. Dengue, I think.
I've heard.
Kind of heard a knock on wood. I think the sickest I've been. I had COVID, like everybody these days. But
you get these spasms that are why they call it breakbone fever.
Yep.
Wow.
I don't recommend it. That is my podcast non-recommendation.
If you take anything away,
zero
from this,
stars.
Yeah.
Right. And anyway, so then the U.S. also right around the time decides, hey, the Philippines, because really the U.S., this is one of the, a thread that comes up or a theme that comes up a few times in your book. A lot of the U.S. commercial interests are always sort of like, are thinking very deeply about China and access to China markets and controlling shipping lanes. I mean, it's not anything new among the sort of ruling class in this country.
It's the eternal dream.
Yeah.
It's the eternal dream. You look, you say, oh my God, there's 1.6 billion people.
Yeah.
If I could sell this app to 0.5% of them, I could retire.
Because the British Empire had already sold them the ultimate app.
Exactly.
A truly addictive little app.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly. And a lot of Americans made money off of that as well, I'll say.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
Including the founders of a number of American political dynasties.
Right.
Including the Forbeses and the Delanos.
Yeah. So describe for our listeners, if you could, briefly, he goes to the Philippines to Luzon. He's there. He arrives after, I think, the U.S. has already taken Manila, if I remember right,
He gets there in 1899. Basically the first act of the war. So the Americans are fighting alongside, just like in Cuba, where we're fighting alongside the Cubans, we're fighting alongside the Filipinos. And just like in Cuba, we then immediately betray them once the Spanish are defeated. And so the first act really of what becomes the Philippine-American War is the Americans essentially colluding with the Spanish to surrender the city of Manila to the Americans so that the Spanish didn't have to have the disgrace of surrendering their city to the local Malay population. They felt much more comfortable surrendering it to a white power like they were. And I also want to know, just in terms of like historical denialism, one thing that's interesting is that, you see this everywhere, including in the Spanish Empire. The Spanish Empire, which is like, what empire is more of an empire than the Spanish Empire? Right. They refused to call their colonial possessions colonies basically until the Bourbon reforms. Like throughout the first couple centuries of Spanish rule over both the Americas and the Philippines, it was always the Kingdom of Peru, the Kingdom of Mexico, the Audiencia of the Philippines. They also were like, we're just here to help. We're just here to give you guys Catholicism. And like, we'll take a bunch of gold and money and silver off the back end. Again, there's bad people everywhere. So the Americans have taken Manila, and the Filipinos who believed that the Americans were going to essentially do for them what the French, what Lafayette did for the Americans in the American Revolution, are horrified and betrayed, and they the first shot is fired by an American, but a war breaks out between the Americans and the Filipinos, and Butler is basically part of a reinforcement battalion. This is the War Nerd podcast. I need to get these things accurate.
Right.
Because they're federalized infantry. At that point, the army is still sort of in its 19th century formation of state volunteer forces, and each governor has some control over the troops that get sent, and Congress is ultimately has the authority, but the president has the direct authority over the Marines because they're Marine infantry, and the Navy was already fully federalized because it had to be because it was boats going into the ocean.
Right.
No one state could have control over that. So McKinley basically sends in a bunch of Marine reinforcements, and that includes Butler. And that's where Butler sees his first action in the Battle of Noveleta.
Mm-hmm. I thought this was really interesting here and I can very much see it and understand it. Very sad and interesting that what you got into how the Filipinos had a very brutal and bitter experience with American colonialism. Mm-hmm. The various insurgency and the counterinsurgency campaigns waged by the U.S. killed, 750,000 or more Filipinos. And we're talking a century ago. So proportionally, that would be millions by today's standards. Yeah. And you have a quote here, people here don't ask questions about the past and the manufacturing of amnesia. It's sort of like, it's too painful. It's also shameful. Underneath it all, there's also this kind of sad desire to still sort of believe that that there could be something good with the U.S., I think, in a lot of people as well. Yeah. I don't know, but it was... If you could talk about a little bit of that at all, like what you saw personally when going out there, because you have three chapters on the Philippines,
right.
The most brutal one being Samar, I think, the whole battle there.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, Butler ends up coming back and is posted at Subic Bay a couple of years later. And then in between is the episode on Samar, which is, yeah, as you say, it's an absolutely horrific chapter. Butler is not personally involved in that one,
right.
but his fellow Marines, including his extremely racist mentor, Littleton Waller, plays basically the starring role in that. But Butler would have been there if he hadn't basically contracted yet another disease, typhoid, in China during the operation just before that. Filipino historical memory is the historical memories of all these countries that I went to is fascinating, and just like ours, there's no pure, unadulterated historical memory out there. I mean, sometimes people look at other countries overseas and imagine like, oh, you know, we are the corrupted adults, and they are the pure children who are just talking about their innocent experiences. And this isn't the case, right? Everybody's mediating their historical memory through events that have happened between now and then, the needs of the past, the needs of the present, what they want to believe about themselves. And in the Philippines, you know, talking about anything that happened in the early 20th century requires you have to wend your way through the crucible of World War II, which, as big a deal as it was in the rest of the United States, right? Because the Philippines was part of the United States during that war, throughout that war, it was much. I mean, you know, in the United States, it was ultimately a foreign war from the perspective of the metropole, of the mainland. In the Philippines, it happened to them. I mean, the Manila at the end of that war was the second worst bombed city in the world after Warsaw. It was completely obliterated. And because of the experience of people who are, you know, a generation that is now dying out under Japanese imperialism, and having fought with the Americans to extricate the Japanese, and then the Americans extremely helpfully give them their long belated independence in 1946, the year after the war ends, Manila is literally in rubble, and Harry Truman is like, good luck. Thanks for your service. Have a good time. So that's part of I think what makes it more complicated looking back. Also, because throughout the Cold War and since, you know, the Philippines remains a ally, client, partner, junior partner in the American Empire, which, you know, for Filipino elites, for people who are, you know, profiting, you know, in the towns, you know, next to these big U.S. bases, including Subic Bay, which, of course, Smedley Butler helps set up, and Clark Air Force Base, which is one of the big air bases right next to Subic, which we also abandoned one there in ruins in the aftermath of the eruption of Mount Pinatubo in 1991. But so what I'm trying to say is that all of, like, through that whole period, throughout the Marcos dictatorship, and by the way, A. Marcos is now president of the Philippines again, you know, it is...
Well,
it is,
that's kind of a remarkable episode of the ephemeral quality of historical memory there. Like, okay, so Dad wasn't so great. Let's try again.
Exactly. Well, it's complicated, like everything, right? Yeah. And so what's happening in all of these things is that you know, anytime, you know, the thing that a lot of people miss in trying to understand how the world works and how the United States operates in the world is that they don't have an analysis of power. They don't have an analysis of the fact that the United States is the big, powerful, nuclear-armed to the teeth country that is coming in and you know, destroying everything that gets in its way. And also, you know, keeping a ready supply of allies and clients, you know, in, you know, to help serve its you know, larger global foreign policy goals. And for anybody who has been on the wrong end of that, and the Philippines has been on both sides of that, right? Mm-hmm. The Philippines was conquered. They were you know, ran roughshod over and colonized for half a century. They end up being the reason that the Japanese invade the Philippines, it's partially because, you know, they just want the land of the Philippines in sort of a, you know, a Lebensraum kind of, you know, sense of a place to grow food. But it's also a power play. It's because that's an American colony. Mm-hmm. The Japanese and the Americans are fighting each other really over control of the Pacific Rim, and really with the goal, both of their goals, is to be the dominant power that controls China, right? That eternal dream, that eternal market. Mm-hmm. And so, as the Rwandan saying, I forget, it's some East African saying that, you know, when the elephants fight, the grass gets trampled, right? It's the Filipinos are the grass in that instance as well. But, and then they see themselves, they're then in between the United States and its new rival empire after the war in the Soviet Union. And Subic Bay and Clark Air Force Base end up being major forward operating bases to threaten and control the Soviets and the Soviet sphere of influence, and they're afraid that again, you know, if they piss off the Americans and are left to be trampled, that they're going to have the same thing happen, that the Soviets are going to do the same thing to them that the Japanese did, or they don't exactly know how, but it's not going to turn out well, right? And then you have people who have their own sort of, you know, grift in the game. And so because of all of that, there are all these good reasons to, from an elite standpoint, to downplay American colonialism and, you know, America's brutal past in the Philippines. And it doesn't hurt that the older generations during the Cold War, and even some of the oldest people who are alive today, grew up in an American school system that, of course, overtly erased the histories of American colonialism. So in some of these cases, you don't even really have to forget it because you don't have a good grasp of it, a good educational background in it. You have maybe the stories that you've heard from your parents or your grandparents. You have little bits of cultural memory that have sort of filtered down to you, but the process of forgetting becomes easier, which is why it was so interesting when I was there. You know, the reporting that I did for the book, I was there in 2017. So it was before the new Marcos came in when Rodrigo Duterte was president.
Right.
And Duterte was playing his own game where he was trying to reposition the Philippines away from the increasingly unreliable United States, which at that point was run by Donald Trump, toward China and Xi Jinping because they, again, the Philippines has this eternal memory of being caught in the middle between competing empires, and they see themselves again being caught between the United States and China. So the two things you can do are either you can go all in and say, yes, I am totally in bed with one of these two empires, you know, put all the armaments that you want here, put all the controls that you want here, I'm with you, Leather, or, you know, try to sort of play them off each other and be like, well, maybe you guys can give me this and maybe you can give me this. And that was Duterte's tact. And because of that and because of Duterte's own personal, outlook on life and his just sort of inherent trolling nature, he was starting to excavate some of these, you know, memories and some of these histories of the Philippine-American War. At the same time that a new generation of Filipinos raised on the internet with access to information that their parents and grandparents had either suppressed or didn't have access to.
He threatened to show photos, right?
Exactly.
That was so interesting. I mean, because, you know, you normally identify anti-imperialism, I think, at least in the West we do, you know, with a left-wing or Marxist-inspired nationalist movement. But here you have this... I don't know, demagogue. I mean, it's hard to say what his politics are. They're kind of all over the place, but, you know, violent demagoguery, I guess, in some way.
Yeah.
But it's like all he almost had to do was sort of threaten to rip the Band-Aid a little bit. And he didn't go all the way there. He just sort of threatened it. And that enough seemed to have power, which is so interesting.
Anti-imperialism from the perspective of a colony or a former colony often takes the form of revanchist nationalism because the alternative to the empire is you personally ruling, and you do have these past wrongs that you can revanche.
Yes.
Legitimize
yourself. So let's let's go to. I mean, look, a lot of these stories. You follow him through, you know, Central America, Panama and Nicaragua and Veracruz and, you know, Mexico. And they're, I got to say, they're all just, they're, as they accumulate, they're very depressing, sad stories. They're, it's mostly just, you know, massacres of small or large size in the service of business. I mean, basically what he said, it's grim and it's sad. Haiti in a way is kind of the biggest, grimmest, most gruesome story of all those. I mean, they're all pretty grim, but, you know, in Haiti, I mean, Haiti's just suffered more than any other country in it. It's, in this hemisphere probably. And it's just gruesome. But, one thing I wanted to just read out, hold on a sec here, is where, I mean, Butler's imprint there is just everywhere. Even like, as you described, even in the way the roads are set up, you know, Butler and American imperialisms, which to this day, all the roads, they don't lead to each other in the various cities. They all just lead to Port-au-Prince because that's what served the U.S. interests. One of the, you know, most incredible episodes is when the Haitians are going to approve a new constitution. And what the U.S. wants is that this constitution is going to allow foreigners to buy land. And because of Haiti's, you know, horrific history as a colony, as a slave colony, that's a red line for just about anybody, even people on the take. And so the Congress finally says, no, we can't pass that. And so Butler just shows up with Marines and bayonets and says, you're dissolved and there's no more democracy. And you have this line here. I mean, I have to say this, like this episode, I just hadn't seen it sort of described like this before, I guess. And so it is kind of, it's, you know, it does kind of hit you. And so, you know, Haiti's legislature was dissolved. It would not meet again for another 12 years. Here's what you write. Power, Butler knew, depended not only on violence, but also on the control of information. If word got out of the Marines' role in the shuttering of Parliament, Haitians would be scandalized. So he summoned the editors of all the national papers to a gendarmerie headquarters where they were ordered not to publish any details. And later that day, according to a commission, Butler had the records of the assembly's last votes removed from the parliamentary archives. So I mean, that direct role in it, it was just erased from history. It's pretty scary. I mean, you know, it's...
And we probably
it's unusual for a colonist of that era. Most of them were very ill-advisedly boastful people, but that's more in the Anglo-Saxon tradition.
Maybe in part it was because he was starting to open his eyes a little bit and was starting to feel a little bit of empathy, that in some ways made him an even more dangerous tool of empire, was because that's the thing that we see in Haiti a lot.
That's a good point. Yeah.
The other thing that he's doing in Haiti at that time is he and his Marines are their field notes in crushing the insurgency that known as the CACOs in northern Haiti. Their field notes become the basis for the Small Wars Manual, which then becomes the basis of counterinsurgency doctrine. And in a lot of ways, I mean, I make this argument. The reason why Butler was so effective as a Marine and as a warfighter in Haiti was because he was a little bit less racist than his superiors. He was able to see the Haitians as people with feelings, which then made it possible for him to then manipulate those feelings.
Yeah,
that's all very true. Yeah, I mean, look, in a lot of ways. You know, Gangsters is a book about historical memory. And that moment in the Haitian parliamentary archives where he's destroying the records, that's a moment of the suppression of memory, of history. And one of the things that I was thinking about, like, as I was writing that is, you know, the reason why we know that this happened is because the head of the Haitian Senate, a guy named Stenio Vincent, who ends up becoming president of Haiti, is actually the president of Haiti when the Americans withdraw under Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1934. But in the 1920s, So Woodrow Wilson, Democratic president, is in power during the invasion of Haiti. Power changes hands in the United States. Now the Republicans are in charge, and the Republicans, hold a series of hearings about American abuses in Haiti and the Dominican Republic, Santo Domingo. And it's at that hearing, basically, Stenio Vincent has come to testify. He's been working, I believe, with the NAACP, which also played a major role in opposing the U.S. occupation. And so it's only because he tells Congress what had happened that there's any real, there's only real record of it, a contemporaneous record. And Butler also is called to testify, and he doesn't deny any of this because it's what happened. And at that point, from his standpoint, from the American standpoint, the horse has long since left the barn. Right. It's 1921. All this stuff happened in 1917. Sure, we can talk about it now. But think about all the things that didn't happen for. All the episodes of American imperialism, that did have the records destroyed, or that nobody bothered to write down, or that everybody sort of swore kind of a pact of omerta, or even that the colonized people, like we were just talking about in the Philippines, that they felt a need to suppress it themselves for their own either personal or national goals. Who knows what else is out there that is waiting to be discovered or uncovered. But that was the British Empire here, right, John?
I mean, it's
a lot of it is at the bottom of the Indian Ocean.
I mean, the Carolyn Elkins book on Kenya, we had no idea. She just happened to basically, tape together some torn up document, more or less, found out that the British put the entire Kikuyu population in concentration camps and tortured and murdered God knows how many tens of thousands in the 50s, when we had TV and no one knew about it, and they thought they burned everything, but she found some stuff. It's pretty scary to think how much we don't know. Yeah, but anyway.
British are another example of Americans who object to the imperial label to describe ourselves often say, well, we're not a real empire like the British. But the British also engage in generations of denialism.
Right.
And if you go, if you're growing up in British schools, people have passed through them. It's like you don't learn. They don't teach this stuff.
We built them railroads and gave them democracy. What's the problem here?
Yeah. We built beautiful train stations in India. They're gorgeous. What do you want?
I think we should leave it there. I mean, all we can do is tell people, get the book. It's a brilliant book. And it really is.
It's really well written. It's a great structure. Like the whole thing, it's really well done. Good gift, for the holidays. Yeah.
Buy it for your favorite capitalist or imperialist. Yeah,
that's right. Okay, well, thank you so much, Jonathan Katz, for joining us. We'll put links to his books and to his newsletter, theracket.news. And anyway, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Okay, that was our interview with Jonathan Katz. Get his book, Gangsters of Capitalism, and sign up to his newsletter, theracket.news. Anyway, thanks again. That was a great interview. And I think we could just wrap it up here.
Yeah.
Good. All right. Until next episode. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.